It's a Game 3 themed episode, reviews and previews, coming up next. What you doing, daddy? This is the Mr. Vincent Podcast, episode 144. I'm your host, Emmanuel Vincent. A special Saturday edition of the Mr. Vincent Podcast, I might add, as I usually don't drop episodes on the weekend. Some of you may know that already. But it is the playoffs, so it's plenty to talk about. As last night, two game threes in the conference semis took place. Knicks versus Pacers, and of course, Nuggets versus Wolves, in which we saw both series are now 2-1. The Nuggets, they answered the call. A lot of people were questioning them after that embarrassment of a performance against the Wolves in game two. They came out from the gate, played with the heart of a champion, and now looks like the momentum has shifted in that series. I think I mentioned in the pod that the score was 117-80, but in actuality, the score was 117-90 in favor of the Denver Nuggets. I was just kind of tired when I recorded this earlier this morning, so I made that mistake. And of course, we saw the thriller between the Knicks and Pacers. We saw the Pacers be victorious. Kind of gives you that old school vibes back in the days of Reggie Miller and Pat Ewing in the 90s when the Knicks and Pacers are going at it. I really do love this series. And of course, we got two games slated for today between the Celtics and Cavs as the series now shifts to Cleveland, and later on between the Thunder and Mavs. Two very interesting series as well. Can't wait. So I preview those as well. And it was a pretty good pod, but we can actually get into it right now. Here it is. All right, so we are recording this Saturday morning after the game threes that took place last night. It looks like the eulogy was written prematurely for the Denver Nuggets as they were able to win game three in convincing fashion against the Minnesota Timberwolves. Now the series is 2-1 in favor of many, but the momentum for damn sure is all on the Nuggets side at this point. What a great performance by the Denver Nuggets, answering the call from many fans and critics and journalists out there, including myself, who were just couldn't believe that they were just decimated the way they were in game two and just destroyed by that Timberwolves defense. And they answered the call. And I think that it really started with Jamal Murray. That was my critique of the Nuggets, of what they had to do to avoid a 3-0 hole in the series. They had to find a way to get Jamal Murray going early because, like I mentioned before in the past, outside of that Lakers series where he hit a couple of the game winners and the clinching game, game five, he's really been relatively pedestrian, at least by his standards, in the playoffs. And also the Nuggets have been getting off to so much slow starts, and it was just an ongoing theme throughout these playoffs. But that wasn't the case last night. They were focused. They got Jamal Murray the ball on dribble handoffs or in ball screens, had some movement, getting some good looks. And I think that that's just trickled throughout the whole team. They were clicking on all cylinders from the get. Nikola Jokic, I thought, played a brilliant game. That's what I love about Nikola Jokic. You could look at his stats, and it's not eye-popping necessarily, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he's not impacting the game, because it was like between the first and second half, it was day and night as to how he was approaching the game. First half, he was trying to, you know, just getting a feeling for the game, wasn't forcing anything. He was essentially taking what the defense was giving him, whether he's finding his players on the dunker spot or, you know, kicking out to shooters. He was just getting a feel for the game, wasn't forcing the issue. Whereas in the second half, he was looking to be a little bit more aggressive, picking his spots and getting some good looks. So this is the Denver Nuggets that I think we are all accustomed to seeing. This is the reason why they are the defending champs. I didn't think that they were going to be swept even after game two. I thought that they're probably going to lose the series, but there's no way. You have to give the defending champs the benefit of the doubt. A team that many, including myself, has compared to the San Antonio Spurs of their heydays, or even the Golden State Warriors, the teams that a well-oiled machine that plays with camaraderie and executes well, especially in the down the stretch of close games. So with that alone, I felt like there's no way in hell that they were going to be swept in this series. If they were to be swept, that would have been a complete, utter embarrassment. But that is not in the case anymore. And now I think that, you know what? I know I'm flip-flopping everything, but now I think they could actually win this series. I did pick them originally to win the series in six, which means that they would have to win four in a row against this Minnesota's defense. I just don't see that happening. But I could see a world where they actually win this series in seven, seeing that they would have home court advantage, and then I think the momentum would be on their side. So Jamal Murray did have 18 points at the first half. He had 2 points in the first half in games one and two combined. Finished with 24 for the game. Him and Nikola Jokic both had 24 points each. Ant-Man, 19 points, 8 of 15 from the field. Wasn't really a great game, particularly based on what we've seen him play at throughout this postseason. He had a rough shooting night, and his teammates, you know, didn't really help out on the offensive end. Another thing about Denver, they actually won the turnover battle. They were minus five in that department, and plus seven in the offensive boards department. They've been looking like a mess out there for most of the series, with these careless turnovers, like this head scratching turnovers. Like, what is going on? I know the defense is great, but these guys just looked like they didn't know how to dribble anymore. They couldn't like be poised in tight situations, and they really just reversed all of that, I think, with last night alone. It was a great performance. Justin Holiday was great off the bench. Brown really did provide some good energy off the bench as well. I seen that they didn't elect to took Peyton Watson out of the rotation. Probably was a tough choice by Mike Malone, considering how that he was really his go-to guy off the bench for a good majority of the season. I know he's a young player. He's going to have some ups and downs, but at this moment in the series, being down 0-2, it's probably a good choice to go with like the more experienced option and Justin Holiday, and that paid dividends. I think last night. Aaron Gordon. He kind of picked off where he left off at in the second half, hitting some clutch threes. Michael Porter Jr. had a bounce back game as well. This unit, that is the best starting five I think in the league, not necessarily by talent, but in terms of execution, camaraderie, familiarity. I don't see a starting five better than the Denver Nuggets, and that was really on full display last night. The Wolves kind of came back to earth in a sense, because for some reason they were really shooting well from the field, along with playing great defense. For most of the series, most of the season, for those who are casual fans of basketball, the Wolves were an excellent defensive team, the best defensive team in the league. But their offense was really up and down. They don't really have enough scoring, I think, on the perimeter to help out Ant-Man. And that was essentially what transpired last night. And I credit the Denver Nuggets to being more active with closing out on the shooters, fighting screens, communicating. They looked like the team that was more desperate in game three. And that should be the case if you're down 0-2. So I want to give them credit for that. But at the same time, the Wolves' lack of perimeter scoring looks like it came back to haunt them last night. We'll see if that trend continues throughout the rest of the series. But it just didn't look good for the Wolves last night. But now we have a real, I think we have a real series, even though it's not tied, even though it's not 2-2. I think we have a real series now. So far, nobody has won in their home court. We'll see if that trend continues on Sunday. And we'll see if Jamal Murray is going to be able to duplicate this type of performance, like this type of, get this type of energy, play with this type of force, because these games are now every other day now, whereas between, he had about 3 games rest between game 2 and game 3, and we know he had the calf strain, the light calf strain that he was dealing with. So we'll see if that's going to be a problem for him as in game 4 on Sunday. But I don't think that it will be too much of a problem, because I'm sure he's going to get all round the clock treatment. He's not having to travel to get on a plane. They're going to stay in Minnesota for game 4, so I think that he will be relatively fine. But I can see a world where the series is 2-2 heading back to Denver. That will be interesting if it goes down 2-2. I think if it's 2-2 heading back to Denver, automatically, all the pressure is shifted on to the Minnesota Timberwolves. You can say right now that the pressure is shifted onto them, but you can't deny that if they were to fall in game 4 again and have the series move to Denver for a game 5, and that hostile environment, high altitude, that crowd's going to be just electric and going to want to like help propel their team to a 3-2 victory. So we'll see how that transpires. This game 2 wasn't really as physical as game 1, which I think kind of as game 2, and I think that really did benefit the Denver Nuggets, because you see how it was like livid at some of the non-calls that transpired. I mean, they felt like, and Jamal Murray himself felt like he was getting just straight like harassed by the likes of Alexander Walker and McDaniels, and you see Mike Malone coming out to defend Murray, getting in the face of the referee, not even getting ejected. Then we see, but now it kind of felt like the roles are somewhat reversed. There was some complaining going on by the Wolves, not to the extent of the Nuggets. They had a lot more composure in that department, but the frustrations was there. We've seen it was Alexander Walker who was a little mad at that there was a no call on Joker for the screen that he set, but I don't think that it was an illegal screen at all. Looked like it was just a solid screen, just a big body that Alexander Walker just happened to run into. I don't think that you should call that and that at all. It's playoff basketball. This series is interesting. I did pick the Nuggets in 6 to win originally. Not sure if it's going to happen. And 6 could be 7. But damn, this is a good series. Whoever wins this series probably is going to win the NBA championship, honestly. So that's cool. Then we had in the opening contest of NBA basketball, got for some eyes, game 3 between the Knicks and the Pacers. And was the Pacers win game 3, 111 to 106, and which the Knicks now have a 2-1 series lead. This game was just, it was just hard to describe this game. It was good. I wouldn't say it was a classic, but it was good and entertaining, certainly. Brunson went off. I can't say he necessarily went off. He had 26 points and took 26 shots to get his 26 points. But he did play solid down the stretch of the game. Remember, he had dealing with a bad foot, and the Pacers did a good job to elect to have Nesmith on him primarily as opposed to Nembhard. He's just had a way with Nembhard throughout this entire series thus far. Just too strong, too physical for him that he could get separation, get the look that he wants to get, whereas against Nesmith, who has the strength that can test Brunson, it's a little bit more difficult. And then, of course, we got to take factor in the fact that he is dealing with a foot injury. So that's what's going to make him work harder as well, too. DiVincenzo was just amazing from tonight. Last night, 35 points, 7-11 from the field. However, he kind of faded away in the clutch of the game. They didn't really look to get him involved. They should have looked to get him involved because the Pacers weren't really guarding him with the attention that was needed in that game, considering that he was just torching them. They weren't really closing out. They were sagging off him too much, not closing out hard enough, and he was just torching for the good majority of the game. Yeah, the series is good. Now, I did think that, oh yeah, Anunoby too. Anunoby was greatly missed in this series because we've seen that Josh Hart had a hard time dealing with Siakam because, you know, Anunoby is really the primary defender for Siakam because he has the length to deal with him, whereas Josh Hart doesn't. And we've seen Josh Hart getting frustrated at the calls that were made yesterday. Yeah, and I could think the fatigue kicked in for the Knicks as well because they're dealing with so many injuries. I mean, Josh Hart sat for the first time in the third quarter this entire series, which is insane. He really sat down for the first time in Game 3. They just don't have enough bodies. I mean, they do, but then again, this is Tibbs' style, you know, kind of playing guys a little bit too much. But you see it, Precious Achiuwa getting more playing time and Burks filling in as well too. So they're going to have to monitor this situation as the series transpires. Haliburton did a good job, I felt like, in Game 3, being very aggressive because he faded away in Game 2, in the second half of Game 2. He was brilliant in Game 1. Then he got away from being aggressive, was really being more passive, and I think that was the detriment of the Pacers because they needed him and they needed his scoring. He realized that last night, and they were able to capitalize off his performance. He did get injured, it looks like, or came down on his ankle weird on a fast break layup. He was able to finish the game, but we've seen him kind of grimacing and showing signs of pain that he was, like, dealing with, wasn't really comfortable out there. So that should be something to monitor as a series progressive. As I mentioned, too, all these games are now every other day. So how is he going to recover from that? So that would be something to take a close look at as the series progresses. The series is damn good. 90s throwback. These teams, for some reason, when these teams go where it is, it's always entertaining whenever they meet in the playoffs. It happened in the 90s. Happened that one time. It was pretty entertaining too with the days of Paul George, Roy Hibbert, and them against like Melo in New York. That was pretty entertaining too. Not to this level, I think. Definitely not to the level of the 90s with Reggie Miller and Pat Ewing and them. But this thus far is entertaining. I think that the injuries are gonna catch up to the Knicks. I don't know how much. And I think that they have solved, the Pacers have found something with having Nesmith as the primary defender on Brunson. Brunson's been torching them virtually all series. Like I mentioned, he did make some clutch shots down the stretch of the game in the fourth quarter, but it wasn't enough. He kind of missed some bunnies too late in the game. A ridiculous attempt at trying to get a foul on a three-point shot instead of actually trying to make the three-point shot, was looking for a foul and show signs of frustration there. That's ridiculous, man. I just don't know how the Knicks can sustain these injuries that are piling up on their team. I think that the Pacers are going to – I think they're going to capitalize off this in advance in the series. I definitely have the Knicks winning in 6, but with all these injuries that are piling up for them, I don't see a world where that's going to be possible, where they're going to win. And we don't know, and Anunoby was out for the game with the hamstring injury. There's no way in hell he's going to come back. With the hamstring injury, you got to be – it requires a lot of icing and resting. Rest is important. So with these games every other day, I don't think he's going to come back. And if they were to come back and – sorry, if they were the Knicks to win this series, I don't think that he'll be back for the next series as well. It's just too risky. So I do think that the Pacers have found something here. Like I said – Brunson, 26 points on 26 shots. That's not a good formula for success for the Knicks. You're not going to stop a player of Brunson's caliber, but you can only hope to make him work hard for his buckets and to make him less efficient than he normally is. And that's what transpired in Game 3. And I think that there's a good chance that can transpire for the most part throughout the rest of the series. All right, so today we have two games slated for today. First coming up, Game 3 between the Cavaliers and the Celtics. Celtics are the visiting team. Cavaliers are at home now for Game 3. Cavs coming off an impressive, to say the least, Game 2 victory, 118-94, which left a lot of Boston Celtic fans upset at their team, just like questioning them and their championship pedigree or lack thereof, and do they really have what it takes to win the championship? And I think it's a little bit of an overreaction. I can't see a world where the Boston Celtics lose this series. If they do, oh my goodness, it will be one of the most epic failures in Boston Celtics history, considering all the breaks that they have in the Eastern Conference with the likes of Jimmy Butler being not being available for the playoffs, Embiid being hobbled entering the playoffs, Giannis not being available for the postseason. These are top dogs in the Eastern Conference, and they're not available, and the Celtics can't capitalize off that. Then I think that there'll be some significant changes coming to the team in the offseason, probably with Mazzulla being relieved of his duties as head coach. But I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, I know that the Mitchell went off 29 points, 8 assists, 5 three-pointers made in that game. Cavs won the rebounding battle 44-31. Mobley took advantage of his size in the interior. Porzingis not being available definitely hurt them in that department. So he took advantage of that. But we got to remember that Jared Allen hasn't been available for the series yet. I think he may be available for Game 3. If he's available for Game 3, that just gives a real advantage to the Cavs in Game 3 and the rest of the series. But we'll see if that actually happens. But keep a look on that. Jason Tatum hasn't really been playing like himself in these playoffs. He's shooting just under 41% from the field and averaging 21 points in the playoffs. That's not a good recipe for success. He can get away from it. I think he can get away with it right now in these conference semis and possibly the Eastern Conference Finals. But in the finals, whoever you play out of the West, you're going to need Jason Tatum to play like Jason Tatum if you want a real chance to hang up banner 18 in the Garden. And then his comments didn't help in the post game, you know, just saying how I'm paraphrasing how the fans think that the sky is falling rather when they lose a game, think that they should win every game, that they don't really have a real super team, because if they did, it would have been reflected with the season awards and accolades and everything. And I don't know if I want to hear that from my best player. If I was a Celtics fan, I would be a little salty about those comments. I don't want to hear that from my best player. I just want to hear, you know, something along the lines of, like, we played bad, but we know not going to be easy. No one said it's going to be easy. We played bad, but we got to come back and fight harder for next game if we want to win this next game or the next series. Something along the lines of that would have been more suitable, I think, and it would have been easier for Celtics fans to digest rather than what he mentioned after the Game 2 loss. I just remember that the Celtics did shoot relatively bad from three-point range in the Game 2. They shot 23% from three, which is atrocious. This team, I just feel like that's been the case for the majority of the season, that they essentially have been a front-running team. When the threes are flying, it's just like it's just an avalanche that the defense, that the opposing team just can't overcome, right? But when the threes aren't falling, then they just force the action to continue to shoot threes instead of getting easier looks at the basket, settling for mid ranges, and of course that their the lack of like the turnovers that transpire in the half court and everything. I think that has come back. That was reflected in Game 2, but I can't see a world where that's gonna really be reflected going out for the majority of the series going forward. I think that they are going to win this series. I picked them to win the series in six. It could very well be seven, but I think the Boston Celtics are going to win the series. You can relax, Seas fans. You can relax. The world is not coming to an end. I think they're going to live to advance to the Eastern Conference Finals. But Mitchell has been great so far. Garland stepped up in Game 2 along with LeVert. They've got some. They aren't the Miami Heat. They aren't the depleted Miami Heat that had all these deficiencies. You're going to have to bring more of an effort to beat the Cavs, which I think the Seas are going to realize. And I think that I don't know if they're going to win Game 3. I can see a world where the Cavs win Game 3 after having the momentum swing in their direction at the Game 2 and they can take advantage of the home crowd that's going to be there in Cleveland. And they can just play off them and that energy that's going to be in the building. And you know that the role players do play way better at home. So the likes of like Strauss can go, I guess he hit like 4 or 5 threes in this game, and that can swing the game in their favor. So yeah, I probably think that would go with the Cavs to win game 3. But again, I think the Celtics are going to win this series. And in the nightcap, we have the Mavs hosting the Oklahoma City Thunder in game 3. The Mavs won game 2, 119 to 110. Luka had 29, 10, and 7. SGA, 33, 12, and 8. SGA didn't really have much help outside of Jalen Williams. Shet played a pedestrian game with 11 points. But the Mavs are here, and I think kind of similar to what's going on in the Eastern Conference that I just mentioned with the Celtics and the Cavs, all the momentum's now on Dallas' side. Now, I did pick Dallas to win this series in 6, and I wasn't really I wasn't swayed after game 1's lost to the Thunder, because, I mean, you got to think about it. The Thunder had rest. They have young legs, being the youngest number one seed ever in the history of basketball, of the NBA. And they swept the series against the Pelicans, whereas the Mavs had a tougher first-round matchup with the Clippers. You got to bang up Luka, who sprained his knee, I believe, in game 3 of that series. So, of course, OKC, younger legs, well-rested, amazing crowd behind them and down there. They took advantage, and they looked like they're a fresher team, and they were able to just capitalize and get game 1. But I knew that you're not going to keep Luka and Kyrie down for too long. It's going to be very hard to stop either one of them, let alone both of them in a game, right? So I knew the Mavs were going to essentially was very confident in the Mavs winning game 2, and that the series would be, after game 1, that the series would be tied up heading back to Dallas. And that's a fact what it is. Now, Luka has been playing not to his normal standards that we've seen, that we've grown accustomed to in the postseason. The fact that he is dealing with the knee issue, and I think he got his ankle foot on, that kind of aggravated an ankle issue he had by Carson Wallace. But he is questionable to play. There's no way in hell he's not playing. He's definitely going to play, and definitely going to play in game 3. I can't doubt that. And I think that they are going to take advantage right now and win game 3. I think Luka's going to have a relatively big game. Kyrie is going to be solid as well, too. Derek Lively is going to be the energizer that he is. He's going to take advantage. That home crowd is going to rub up on him. And Gafford is going to be active as well. I think that OKC's inexperience is going to start to show games 3 and game 4. Not saying they're going to lose both games, but I think their inexperience, their youth, is going to show in these games, Slater, because this is going to be a tough environment. This is a pivotal game 3, and turn will be, I think, will be a pivotal game 4 for them. So I think that it's going to show. But they've been great. They got the number one seed for a reason. Dallas picked up caught heat on the season after the trade deadline when they acquired Gafford and PJ Washington, and they've been rolling ever since. One of the hottest teams in the NBA. I think that that's going to roll into game 3. I picked the Mavs to, like I mentioned, I picked the Mavs to win the series in 6. I'm still confident that's going to happen, that they're going to win in 6, even with the hobble Luka Doncic. Luka's just on another level. Best play in the series. You got Kyrie. You got a solid supporting cast down there in Dallas too as well. They are young in OKC, but they lack an interior presence. I think that Gafford and Derek Lively are going to take advantage of going forward. I think that this is going to be the roadblock that's going to derail the Thunder this postseason, but they are going to be able to build off this going forward because they have a great foundation. They have a lot of future draft picks that they can use to acquire some girth in the interior and to help out the likes of SGA, Chet, and Jalen Williams. All right, so Nikola Jokic did win this week, was announced the 2023-2024 league MVP. His third time winning the award in the last four seasons. He joined the likes of Mike, LeBron, Magic, Bird, Wilt, Russell. I think those are the only guys who have at least three or more season MVP awards. Well-deserving, in my estimation. I, however, would have went with SGA, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. I just think that what he did this season, he had a stat line that only Mike and Steph were able to achieve. And I believe in both years they won the league MVP. I'm not too positive about Mike, but he probably did. I know Steph did because Steph had a stat line similar to SGA's in 2016. In the 15-16 season, that's the season when they won 73 games. When they won 73 games, Steph was a member of the 50-40-90 club, averaged 30 points. So I think that's historic in itself. And again, as I mentioned, the Thunder are the youngest number one seed ever in league history. SGA is the best player on that team. Very efficient, good stats. I think that warrants consideration to be the most valuable player in the league. Now, I do know that, you know, it was close. Going into the last game of the season, Thunder, Nuggets, Wolves all were tied for the best record. And that the Thunder did play the Mavs, who were resting Kyrie and Luka because they already had the fifth seed locked up going into the game. So them winning that game wouldn't do anything. It wouldn't change their position in the standings. So, okay. Thunder win that game, blow them out. They're the number one seed. Yeah, but still, I think that SGA should have got it. Now, I can see the case that you can give Nikola Jokic the award, which is why I'm not even mad at the fact that he won it. Nikola Jokic, I think, is the best player in the league. He's shown that for like the past two, three seasons, you could say, right? He's been the best player in the league. Jamal Murray did miss significant time this year. I don't have it in front of me how much games he missed. It's probably around the 20 game range. And they were still able to be the number two seed in the league, in the Western Conference, rather. And Nikola Jokic is the hub for that offense in Denver. As he goes, the Nuggets go. What he does for that team is just, you can't even, like, it's immeasurable. And he's just a unicorn in that sense, right? He's a once-in-a-generation type player, what he brings to the team, what he does. If he was to be out for a significant amount of time, the Nuggets probably, do they make the playoffs? I mean, especially with Jamal Murray missing 20 seasons, do they miss the playoffs? Do they make the playoffs if he misses, like, I don't know, 30, 40 games? Probably not. Not in the Western Conference, in a conference that's so loaded. So I understand why Nikola Jokic won the MVP. And to be honest, let's keep it real. I do think that there's a lot of voters who have the mindset that they were trying to rewrite the wrongs from last season, in which Joel Embiid won the league MVP. Because for a good majority of that season, it was Nikola Jokic's award to win. It wasn't really until Kendrick Perkins came out on First Take and kind of like, you know, insinuate that race is playing a factor into Nikola Jokic being favored over Joel Embiid for league MVP. Once that happened, things kind of changed. Now, the Nuggets actually kind of went on a skid as well, too, and Embiid in the Sixers were rising up. So I think that played a factor into it as well. But anyways, Joel Embiid wins the league MVP. I think there's a lot of people who are thinking that, you know what, we really wanted to vote for Nikola Jokic last season. But no, they felt pressured and didn't want to be deemed as a quote unquote racist. So they decided to, you know, use that vote this year. And two, with SGA, I think that a lot of people don't really watch the Thunder that much because they're not really marketed. They don't have a lot of nationally televised games. Nuggets certainly do because they're the defending champions. So you see them more on ABC or TNT. We don't really see OKC games that much. I think that definitely plays a factor into it. I seen Shaq getting criticized for, you know, sharing the same sentiments as me, essentially, that, you know, if he had a vote, SGA would have got it. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Now, I don't necessarily agree with him letting Joker know about that once they interviewed Joker after he was announced as a league MVP. That probably could have been saved for another moment or even like towards the end of the interview, but not like right in the beginning when I think that was the first question. The first question that Shaq asked him, he started off by saying, "You know, I just want you to hear from me first that I think that SGA should have won the award," and then he proceeded with this question. I don't think that was right. But to say that Shaq was jealous, I think Shannon Sharp, yes, on a podcast, made the claim that Shaq is jealous of Nikola Jokic for winning the MVP, where Shaq only has one, which is kind of crazy, but not crazy at the same time, because if you think about it, Kobe and Shaq did play together for 8 years, and essentially they kind of canceled each other out. I think if Kobe and Shaq, I think if they didn't play with each other, they probably would have multiple league MVPs. Might not have the amount of championships that they have on their resume, but they probably would have more than one league MVP. That's just my opinion. So you have to factor that in as to why Shaq only has one league MVP and the late, great Kobe Bryant as well. But to insinuate that or make that claim that Shaq is jealous of Nikola Jokic, that's crazy to me. Shaq's one of the, on most people's list of the top 10, top 15 greatest players of all time, the most dominating player in the modern era. What Shaq did between 2000 and 2003, just from a physical dominant standpoint, is something that I don't think will ever be replicated again in basketball. Big part of it is because how the game is officiated today and how the game is played with the spacing and everything. But it was just something to watch, man. If you're too young to know who Shaquille O'Neal is watching this podcast, do me a favor, go on YouTube, watch some Shaquille O'Neal highlights from between like 99 to 2003. Guy was amazing, dominant in every aspect. I can't imagine him being jealous of Nikola Jokic for winning a league MVP. And considering how different the game is played today as opposed to how it was back then. But yeah, I definitely would have SGA winning league MVP if it was me. But I'm not mad at Nikola Jokic at all. He's the best player in the league. I wouldn't be mad at Luka Doncic for winning the award. There's very rare instances where I think that it's a runaway as opposed to who's going to win league MVP. And that is the case again this year. If Joel Embiid didn't miss as many games as he did, if he actually met the criteria for the 65-game benchmark, he would have won league MVP. It was going in his direction because the Sixers, I believe, were the number two seed in the Eastern Conference at the time he went down with his injury, with the meniscus injury, and missed all those games. So, and he was just dominating, picking up where he left off at from the previous season. So he would have won league MVP. You can give it to several players every year. Very rare that it's a landslide to me. Now, I think that the voting definitely should have been a lot closer as well with Nikola Jokic and SGA. It was considerably in Nikola Jokic's favor with the votes. But then again, I think that this exposes some people for not paying attention to OKC, having a flyer under the radar, not watching them on League Pass because, again, they don't really have much televised games. Shame on them if that's the case. It should have been a lot closer in voting, but Nikola Jokic winning the MVP. I think when we look back at Nikola Jokic's career several years down the line, that's gonna feel right. Him winning three league MVPs, transcendent player, like everybody else who's won that award three or more times. Transcendent. That is Nikola Jokic. I don't have a problem with that. Late last night, it was announced that the Phoenix Suns did sign Mike Budenholzer to a 5-year deal to be their next head coach. I'm not really mad at that move for the Suns. He's probably one of the best, probably the best coach that's available on the market right now. He does have a great track history coming from the Spurs tree, from the Greg Popovich tree, and then, of course, being the head coach of the Atlanta Hawks and Milwaukee Bucks, in which he had success at both stops. Milwaukee Bucks 1 year had won 60-plus games, had four All-Stars, went to the Eastern Conference Finals, only ran into LeBron James. Did that under Mike Budenholzer, and then, of course, Milwaukee Definitely had multiple 60-win seasons, Giannis being league MVP on multiple occasions, and an NBA championship under Mike Budenholzer. So Budenholzer does have championship pedigree. It's going to be interesting to see what they do in terms of, like, he's more offensive minded than Frank Vogel, where Frank Vogel is heavily a defensive oriented coach. But Mike Budenholzer too does have is a defensive coach too, but not to the extent that Frank Vogel is. So the Suns are going to have to do something to help improve that roster on the defensive end to maximize with Mike Budenholzer being their head coach. But I don't know what the moves are going to be. I haven't really taken a look at their salary, but I know that it's going to be tough when you're paying three guys max money in this NBA climate, where the league is currently structured to go away from having three max players. Two, that's fine, but three, it's a lot. And of course, you have that contract of Bradley Beal that's essentially you can't move due to the fact that he has no trade clause, and who's going to want to take on all that money anyways that he has after that performance that he put on in the playoffs round one, and the fact that he's always hurt, always banged up. So I don't see them being able to move on from him. They can move on from Kevin Durant or Devin Booker, but do you really want to move on from Devin Booker being the young player that he is and the homegrown talent that he is? I don't really see that you can win a championship with Devin Booker being your best player. I mean, if you look at it, he really didn't really do anything significant in his career until the arrival of Chris Paul. And Chris Paul was the leader of the team, wasn't the best player, but in fact was the leader of the team. So are they going to want to move on from Devin Booker? I don't know. I would think that they should consider it at least. And Kevin Durant, does he want to move on again and go to another stop and continue to be perceived as a mercenary, as he currently is by many fans and journalists and analysts or whatever? So that's going to be interesting to see how they retool their team. But Budenholzer certainly was a good pickup for them. And that is it for this episode. I hope you guys enjoyed. And if you're new to this pod, hopefully you'll stick around. And feel free, if you haven't already, to hit that subscribe button, as this pod is available just about everywhere you listen to your favorite pods at. That includes Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and several other platforms as well. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, Mr. Vincent. Again, that YouTube channel is Mr. Vincent, where you'll be able to find this pod as well, along with more content coming down the line. IG, at the Mr. Vincent Pod. Again, the IG for this podcast is at the Mr. Vincent Pod. And if you want to follow me on social media, IG, X, at Mr. Vincent 13. Again, IG and X at Mr. Vincent 13. So that's all the time I have for now. Enjoy the game slated for the weekend. I'll check in with y'all later on in the week. Till then, stay safe. Take care.